Hey everybody, welcome to Real Life Sci-Fi with Wade and Willie. I'm Willie.
I'm Wade.
Wade's out for the day. We got Ahmed Gates filling in today.
Sorry, I talked over you.
That's all right. We have today's episode is music heavy, so it was great to have somebody come in who has a good memory and knows a lot about music. Abed, you want to plug what you're doing right now? You got the Abed Hour on
the Abed Hour
videos.
The Abed Hour, but I'm going to shoot an episode this month. I haven't been doing it regularly, but I do a comic strip. It's on Tapas and Webtoon with Mike Chilian called Lieutenant DePuppo Dog Detective. And if you go to my Instagram, you follow me on Instagram, there's a link to subscribe. Please subscribe because we're on episode 9 and it's a
great.
Lot of fun.
What's your Instagram?
Abed G. A-B-E-D.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Well, you can support us on Patreon. Visit reallifesci-fi.show and we have different tiers of how you can support us. You go up to the high tier, you're buying us a drink and you become a producer of an episode and we say your name. Without further ado, let's welcome our guest. Like I said, this is a music episode. We've got Hollywood Steve Huey. He's a music expert, a historian. You find him on the new Yacht Rock documentary. He's got the Yacht Rock, couple Yacht Rock podcasts out, Yacht or Nyacht, and Beyond Yacht Rock 2000. What's up, Steve?
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good. Yeah, it was great to see you on that Yacht Rock documentary.
This one, they got it all right, it seemed like.
It was really good. Great job, Steve.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved seeing all the, you know, all these brilliant studio musicians finally getting credit also, you know, like,
yeah, as far as I can tell, they all seemed happy with it. Like, you know, even if they had to put up with some smartassery along the way, it seemed like they were all, you know, at bottom happy that they were being portrayed as having a creative legacy and it was, you know, being seen in a positive light by the younger folks.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I know, and we'll get into this tonight, too, maybe a little bit. But like, you know, when disco ended, people were mad at disco. People hated disco. You know, there's famous signs. It's like, fuck disco.
Disco sucks.
And, you know, Yacht Rock never really had that sort of ending. It just the music industry just kind of shifted. There wasn't like a fuck this smooth.
Well, it wasn't really a style, right?
Yeah,
Steve,
yeah.
We've kind of found little bits and pieces where people tried to figure out what this style was and what it should be called, but they don't quite get there. But yeah, people kind of knew that it was something, but they weren't quite sure what, and they didn't really separate it out all that much because it wasn't, you know, nobody nerded out about adult contemporary music.
It was radio when I was growing
up. It was basically just called soft rock.
Yeah.
And the category was too big.
Yeah, it was easy listening.
Easy listening or MOR for middle of the road. And ew, gross.
Isn't there a joke in Simpsons when Marge is in the store and then like she goes, I haven't heard of any of these bands, Pablo Cruz or, and I think some of them are Yacht Rock bands. And then they go, Crap Rock? I'm not quoting it correctly, but I remember them saying Crap Rock. Or no, Wuss Rock. Like Bart goes, Wuss Rock.
It vaguely rings a bell. It sounds familiar.
But it was where those bands lived. It was like,
yes,
you'd go to Walgreens and there'd be like that section, right, of just cassette tapes that nobody wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also that bit in the episode where Milhouse's parents get divorced and Kirk Van Houten makes his demo tape.
Oh, I love that episode.
And they like, anybody like the Doobie Brothers? Because we've got one of them.
That's great. I don't remember that joke. I just remember Can I Borrow a Feeling was the name of the album.
That's how they introduced the band for Can I Borrow a Feeling. But there are certain obscure Yacht Rock records where like the first thing that pops into my head is, oh my God, this is like Can I Borrow a Feeling, but with a better singer.
That's funny. Oh my God, Can I Borrow a Feeling? It needs to be a shirt. No, I was gonna say, like, I, you know what's funny, when you guys did Yacht Rock, I grew up, I liked Hall & Oates and I liked Journey, but I didn't really get into Yacht Rock. And then I think, like, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago before COVID, I became obsessed with Steely Dan. Like,
it happens, like, to everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
The older you get,
They just sink into your psyche, and they became like my soundtrack. Like, I would listen to them all the time.
Yeah, you just kind of have to calm down first, and then they're there.
It's so true, man. And I think I was with Mike in my car, and I was like, dude, like, do you like Steely Dan? Because you played them. And he was like, no, I'm not a fan. And then I played it for him, and he's like, yeah, I don't like it. And, like, and then, like, I want to say, like, 2 years ago, Mike became a fan.
Well, you can't listen to Bodhisattva till you know what it means.
I don't,
and who it's making fun of.
I don't think I know what it means now.
I mean, there's a lot of decoding you have to do with any Steely Dan song.
Especially when he gets drunk and dies at the wheel. Like, that's the fucking Deacon Blues is a masterpiece. Yeah. Anyway.
So let's do the wow scale real quick.
Wow scale. Are you a wait or are you a willie?
The wow scale stands for wait or willie. I'll ask you some questions, and then at the end of it, I'll tell you if you're closer to a zero, which you would be weighed on the scale, or closer to a five, you'd be more of a willy. Are you ready to be weighed on the wow scale?
Weigh away.
I willy want to weigh you. First question, three-parter. Well, first off, Abed, do you remember your wow scale? You're kind of a 3-4, I was like, right?
I think I was a middle. Like, middle, I wasn't quite a willy or a weight. I was like right in the middle.
Okay. And Steve, I know you've done this before, but we've got some new questions, and we'll make it quick. Okay.
Okay.
First question, three-parter. Do you believe in aliens? If so, have they visited Earth? If so, have they visited Earth in the last 300 years?
I mean, sure, I believe in aliens. It seems arrogant to assume we're the only life forms in the universe, but I don't know that they've visited Earth. I don't think the technology's there yet.
Technology of them to go vast distances across the universe.
Yeah, I don't think they have the technology yet. I think they're still working on it.
Okay, what about ghosts?
I don't know that I believe, but I also don't disbelieve. Like, I don't know. I've never had an experience, but I've heard plenty of stories about people who have, and who am I to say they're making shit up?
Believe is such a hard word, and it's like, well, until you experience something, you're going off of other people's words, stories, descriptions, right. Definitions. What about Bigfoot?
No.
That's my answer too.
I know Bigfoot is a big no for most people. Say no. What about so here's one we is kind of new. You believe 9/11 was an inside job in any sort of way?
Ooh, that's a good question.
In any sort of way?
I know it's weird because I don't want to just say that it was the government, because the version I believe in, it's not necessarily the government that did it, but that there was
the government overlooked it.
Yeah.
I don't believe that they did it on purpose, but once it happened, I think they did seize on that. Like, oh, let's push through a bunch of our terrible police state bullshit.
Ooh, yeah, good answer.
Like I know. Patriot Act.
What Naomi Klein calls the shock doctrine.
Maybe we need to redefine this a little more, because in my version, I do think that somebody was in the towers getting some of that stuff ready, but it wasn't the government.
Getting like the explosives ready.
Yeah. I mean, the thermite that, at any rate, I want to go off on that. What about the multiverse? Do you believe in the multiverse could be real?
No, it seems like a tech bro thing.
It's a good answer.
I know. Right. Like, well, it's good on paper sort of, but, I believe in it, but it's still so fantastic. When I first started looking into it, I was laughing at it, going like, infinite possibilities, infinite realms. Like,
can I say something? Like, it's kind of like people that believe like the Matrix is real. It's like, dude, it's a movie. Like, I kind of believe anything's possible, but when you say multiverse, I just think of Marvel, and I'm like, I think it's just nerds that want that to be true so bad, you know?
And then they make up nerd stuff about how it could be true.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a nerd too, but I just think that's over nerding it.
Yes.
Yeah, like my version kind of lends itself more to consciousness, that we might vibrationally shift into a different version that's happening. It's like we're tuning the universe kind of thing, but it's not like every single thing is actually physically happening, because I also don't believe in the physical world. But anyways, I would say,
whatever's going on, we're too dumb to understand. It's like it's fucking complicated as shit.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I don't know what the hell's going on.
Yeah. In my mind, I'm like, there's no way anybody in the history of humans has ever figured it out.
Yeah, exactly. Like our brains aren't big enough to comprehend that's how I feel. But, you know, maybe it's a defeatist attitude. I don't know.
Steve, I'm going to put you at a one. Wade is a zero. I'm a five. Probably a three. We'll just jump into it. Tonight on Real Life Sci-Fi, the corrupt music industry.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's excited.
Ultimately, we'll go all over the place, but we're going to try to push towards the idea that the music industry has been telling you what the number one hits were, not us telling them. They've been paying themselves and making money and just been corrupt this whole time. Yep. So tonight we have a couple music heads on here that have good memories and know a lot of stuff about music. So let's dive into it tonight on Real Life Sci-Fi. What are your initial thoughts of the corruptness of the music industry? We'll start with Steve, and then Abed, you can answer.
Man, is it corrupt. Because here's the thing. Businesses like predictability. That's what we always hear about, you know, how the economy is being managed on a national basis. Businesses want to plan ahead. They want predictability. They don't want anything to change. They want to just make their long-term strategies and then have everything work out just the way they planned. And when you're in the music industry, sometimes what happens is people's tastes change, or they hear something new and they're like, oh, I want to listen to that instead of this other stuff. And record companies, you know, major label record companies don't like that, because they sank all these financial resources into, you know, signing and promoting and investing in all these other artists. And they don't want those investments to be, you know, sort of defaulted on because public tastes change.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of money changing hands behind the scenes to make sure that they get to pick what's popular so that their investments pay off.
Mm. Very true. Very true.
Abed, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, it's so, I didn't really do research because I have all these obsessions with film. I'm sorry, music, film, film's
film too.
Yeah, film too. But I had a guy on my show, Adam Drucker from Anacon. He's Dose One, amazing rapper. And we started, because he worked with Mogwai. I'm a big fan of Mogwai. But we were talking about like instrumental music and Godspeed You Black Emperor and stuff like that. And I was like just watching because I was uploading this video to my Patreon, and I got this like big epiphany, and it's tied into what we're talking about. Like music during the classical era was more artistry. It was more like Mozart was just doing something that he felt commanded him to create this music. And the minute the radio was invented, it became a business. It became, okay, now you got to make a song. It has to be a hit song, and people have to like it. And I think that's where music shifted. And it's just diminishing. It's gotten worse and worse. Of course, you have Brian Wilson and the Beatles and Elvis. You've got, like, and Prince. You have people that are really artists, and they truly care about the music. But I think, especially in the time we're in now, music is garbage. It's just become so corporate, so just like manufactured. There's like nothing natural or organic about it anymore. And it's why, like, you know, kids nowadays listen to the Beatles because music is so bad. They want something. They want substance.
Well, and when you say music, I'm going to just put words in your mouth by saying the music that's being pushed on everyone. Because like
that's what I'm saying.
There's good music out there.
There's good music, of course. I mean, Mogwai came out with a new album. Like, there's great music still, and I'm obsessed with Granddaddy, and he's doing a new album. You know, like, but
is he big? Because I like him too. Is he?
He's. You know, I've been talking to him. He's not famous. He had a moment because David Bowie was a fan, and that they got huge, but. It's very cult. It's like you're a fan of it if you love music and you like that style. His new album is great, by the way. It's really good. But it's so folksy that it's like in a niche. It's in a style that nothing else, you know what I mean? It can't be a radio hit. It can't be something that's listened to by the kids. You just have to be a fan of what he does. But that's what good music is now. It's like you have to seek it. You have to like go and find these artists when, you know, there was a time when the good shit was on the radio in the 70s, and it's not like that anymore.
Well, it's funny you bring up the 70s, and but Steve sent me a podcast, and I'll probably put a link to it in here, which was really good to listen to, because, you know, when you were saying Mozart was just creatively inspired, I'm like, I don't doubt that, but like they still had to put on a show, and it still had to be good. You know what I mean? You couldn't be.
And they still had to make people have like the rich patrons of the arts from back in those days, you know, all the nobility and the people who were actually sponsoring all of this stuff, you know, to have it reflect well on them. You still had to cater to the rich people's tastes in his time.
True.
You know, but, it wasn't quite a business per se, but
still,
you know,
in
the end, you're still facing these extremely wealthy tastemakers who want things done their way.
I found it interesting. The podcast that you sent me, Steve, So first off, let me just lay the groundwork of in 1960 was when the government stepped in and said, okay, you can't do payola. Payola is when you are paying off radios to play your song.
And it was pretty rampant. And that was Alan Freed, the DJ who coined the term rock and roll, had his career ruined by that.
And even it's funny.
He was far from the only one taking money to play records. Like Dick Clark had his hand in a lot of stuff back then. He got off pretty easy.
I would say 300 times more involved than Alan was because Dick Clark
had like his own labels, and he had his hands in a lot of little different business ventures, and then quietly just kind of divested himself of that after the whole investigation.
Yeah. So they basically let him off
looking fellow. So he got away with it.
Wow. He took his name off all the credits because he had so many songwriting credits. But so Dick Clark back in the day, for people that don't know, had a show. And if he played a song on his show, it would definitely just like get so big that he would instantly make money. Everyone would make money except for probably the band.
Wasn't he an eternal teenager? That was his thing, was like, I'm always a teenager. And he's like a 40-year-old man.
Or a 60-year-old man.
Right. I get what you're saying in that, like, him enjoying music is just like a kid listening to music at home.
Yeah, that
and
was
he likes what the kids like.
That yeah, was a yeah. shtick. Was like, I'm cool too, kids. Because look what I'm playing. I'm playing Beach Boys, right?
So it was interesting to learn that back in the day in the '60s, we'll start in the '60s. Kids didn't buy albums; they bought singles. And I never really knew that. I just figured everyone always bought albums, but no, the kids bought singles. They played the singles.
They were cheaper.
Songs.
Yeah. You know, kids, like even when I was a kid, when I started getting into music that wasn't my parents' music, I bought singles because I heard the song on the radio. I wanted that song.
Me too.
Yeah. I bought like a few $2, cassettes.
Two or three bucks. I was young, right around the time when cassette singles started to take over from 45 RPM records. So I got a lot of those in my closet back in my parents' house.
Can I ask you a question?
I wish I never got rid of mine.
Do you remember the like when you bought cassette singles, do you remember one specifically that you just listened to over and over?
No, I wouldn't listen to the cassette singles over and over. I'd dub them onto longer I'd make an hour long tape on my Memorex.
Yeah, great.
Memorex,
like dub all my cassette singles onto those and play those as mixtapes.
That's a smart way to do it. I'd have to sit by the radio and hit record when the song came on the radio.
Oh, I did so some I of that too. Yeah.
I did that with like, remember Secret of My Success? I did that because I loved the song and my mom didn't let me buy music. So I had to put my cassette recorder next to the speaker and record with 24 hours a day. Remember that song? Night Ranger. Night
24
Ranger.
Hours
a Secret day. Secret of my success. And I'm living. Yeah. Or 25 hours a day, he said. Yeah. But you can hear my mom doing dishes in the background.
Yeah, a couple of mine you could hear me like quieting down, the door open. I'm like, shh, you know, like my brother or sister walked in. I'm like, I'm fucking recording, making my mixtape. And so it was interesting to hear that some of the biggest songs that you thought would be singles later in the 60s weren't singles because they were doing experiments to try to sell albums. So you look at like Stairway to Heaven was a great example.
Right. That was never released as a single.
Are you fucking kidding
Even though
me?
It's, according to legend, the most played song in radio history or something like that.
What was it? Correct me if I'm wrong, but was it like Rubber Soul that they were like trying to make an album?
Between Rubber Soul and Sgt. Pepper, they had a couple singles. Sgt. Pepper was the first album. So it must have. This thing, Sgt. Pepper was the first album to not release a single. The rest of them must have had singles, but and this was an experiment. This is the music industry trying to play with how to get people to buy shit, and because there were no singles sold off
shit.
Because they didn't have a single off Sgt. Pepper, like, people bought the album and they made kids have to buy the album.
I didn't listen to Sgt. Pepper until I was like 20, and it was like a life-changing experience, because like I had friends that liked the Beatles and I grew up thinking like the Beatles suck, like they're just like, oh, I'm a Beatle, blah, 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 blah. And then like they gave me Revolver and said, no, listen to this, and then I was like, oh my god, this is good. And then I changed my opinion, and then I bought Sgt. Pepper at that time.
See, you're lucky to have had that experience, because I grew up listening to, my dad listened to all the 60s stuff, or, you know, Beatles and Jethro Tull. And so I listened to all that stuff. And then my mom listened to R&B and hip hop, or, well, not hip hop back then, but R&B and disco. And so like, I've always listened to the Beatles, and I never really dove deep into them on my own, because I'd always listened to them.
When did Moose listen to Beatles? That's what I want to know.
Oh, good night, buddy.
He would like Beatles, I think.
My dad was a huge Beatles fan, but he would always play the early stuff because I think he just felt like kids would be more into that. So like, we grew up like Love Me Do and Please Please Me in that era of Beatles.
Yeah,
I didn't hear the later, more psychedelic stuff until like, I just didn't hear. He just didn't play that around the house much, so I didn't hear it until much later.
Did he not play it because you were too young to understand it or something?
I don't know. I should ask him.
Yeah, that'd be a good question.
I remember is that he used to let us jump on his bed if we were listening to Love Me Do.
That's a good trade-off.
Yeah, I thought it was a great trade-off.
My mom loved Beatles, and actually she had 45s that she gave me. I wish I still had them.
Oh, dang.
I know. And so she was into them, but I was like young and I didn't understand. I think I liked Beach Boys and Steppenwolf. But when I was young, like, Beatles didn't really grab me. Like, I think I thought they were annoying. You know, like I said, I thought it was just like, oh, I'm a Beatles.
Well, yeah. And that's why I brought up that thing. It's weird how many great musician songwriters there were, you know, I'm going to say Beatles, Beach Boys, all the stuff in that time where like, they were actually really gifted, and sure, they're writing pop hit songs, but if you go back and listen, it's like, man, this is really complicated. This is really good.
Yeah. Well, so
it's a great base to start that time.
Danny Jelinek, we all know him. He got me into Beach Boys, because same with Beach Boys, where I'm like, man, they suck. It's all about them going to the beach and California girls.
I don't listen to these preppy surfing. And I'm like, oh,
well, then Danny Jelinek gave me he made a mix of Beach Boys songs, and they were like, every song was good. And then I discovered Smile and Pet Sounds. And it's like, I'm a Beach Boys fan more than a Beatles fan. Like, I'm obsessed with Brian Wilson. It changed my whole perspective. If you don't pay attention to the pop hits and you go deeper, it's like Sunflower, which is their 70s album, is a fucking masterpiece. And Smile. like find the original version of Smile if you can. They pieced it together from the old tapes, and there's like the original version, because he did a new version. It's not as good, but Smile's like a fucking masterpiece. It is from beginning to end the best album I've ever heard. Sorry, Steve. I didn't mean to. I know you're the guest, and here I am going off about the.
Well, you're kind of a guest too, in a way.
Right. True.
Because you're not Wade.
So I'll just jump back into 60s. The music industry is playing with how to, and the reason why they did that is because sales are going down. Anytime sales are going down, it's like, okay, how do we get people to buy shit? That's just always how it's been. A lot of times, you know, an album may have a couple hits on it, whatever.
But a lot of it was like singles plus filler. Like you got hot singles out. You just rush out an album, like just fill it up with some like crap, or just a bunch of cover tunes, or just, you know, whatever mediocre shit, just to get a record album out there to get people to buy the full album to get that single or two or three or whatever.
Right. And let me go on my little soapbox real quick. I'll just say this real quick, because I always love complaining about this. Johnny Cash, huge sellout. I fucking hate that cover album, because everyone's like, oh, wow, he did Nine Inch Nails. And I'm like, no, he did everything that was on his label. He like the label pushed him to make this. He'd never listen to Nine Inch Nails. Like, don't put that in your head.
Well, no, that was Rick Rubin, his producer, bringing him all these songs.
Oh, Rick. What word. If you guys read Rick Rubin's book, it's really good.
I have not.
No,
he has a great book about how to be an artist, and it's
give us a secret. Give us a secret from it.
Oh, well, in the book, his style is not to apply stuff to his life and tell you how he did things. He does it without saying names so that I can read it and relate. And that's brilliant. I forget what it's called. It's like his book about how to be an artist. But it changed my life. It's a great book. Even if you're not a musician, it's good to read.
Word. Maybe I'll have the audiobook read it to me. In 1977 was the first time that they started having multiple singles on one album. I mean, that were selling good. Fleetwood Mac, their album Rumors had four singles on it. And I just saying, this was a shift to... maybe it was the timing, but like these albums were so good that they had too many hits on them, and then that became the norm. The soundtrack
artists tried to figure out like how to make better albums, like front to back.
It's kind of like if you're making a movie and you have less of a budget, like how do you make a better movie, like Star Wars? It's sort of like that. It's like, oh, you got to make a better album now, so it pushes.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, maybe they took more time, got more input on it, or.
I love Rumors, by the way. I'm a big Fleetwood Mac guy.
Yeah, that was one of the ones that I grew up listening to. The Saturday Night Fever soundtrack had four number ones on it, and then Off the Wall by Michael Jackson, that had four number ones on it, 1979. And then ultimately, the music industry shifted again. 1981, MTV came about. And the first song they played was Video Killed the Radio Star. Very telling piece of the future. Oh, I love that song by the Buggles. But so, I mean, I don't know. I'm just going to brush over the 70s because I didn't experience it. But ultimately, the industry's playing with how to make money. And at the end of the 70s, the norm was to create a good album so that could also sell singles. They were doing albums and singles.
Right. Because I remember like when I was a kid, I do a calculation in my head, like, okay, this artist just came out with a new album. They had a bunch of hits off their last album. Seems likely that they're, you know, if I was going to buy three cassette singles, that would cost me like $9. So it would be worth it to just buy the full album if it's like $10 for the tape. Yeah. If I think there's going to be three hit singles off of it.
Man, I've done that math a few times.
You're like,
right?
A scientist. Like,
I remember doing that for the rock set. Album. I was like, well,
oh, I love Roxette. My
I definitely want to buy these two singles, but I think the album might be worth it.
Is it Listen to Your Heart, like that era?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It's a great song, man. It's funny when you said Roxette, I'm like, immediately thought of that song. I'm like, oh, that's the song that if that's on, I just lose it. Sorry, me and Willie are like the same age. And well, I guess you're also the same age. Like that when that song came out, I was that right age, you know.
That came out in my era of being like obsessed with American Top 40.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Like I had an older brother, so I would still listen to that song in the room without him. Oh, you're in the room. Let's put this Iron Maiden one on. Let's play, you know, some Slayer.
Oh, your brother was like, he was cool. He listened to metal and like,
yeah, yeah. Like
he hated like techno and stuff and like, yeah. And like R&B.
Yeah. Like I, you know, so MTV, like whenever like a Madonna, if there was a song that I wanted to like dance to, like I'd run into the bedroom, lock the door and put it on MTV. Which was still, our TV in the bedroom was black and white, but I'd have to like hide from my family to be like, oh, I want to dance this song.
I used to record videos. I have these videos of just like all these Janet Jackson songs because it'd be like her special or whatever. Or I'd record BET and it would be, I can't remember the rap, whatever their rap section was. And I remember recording Mystery of the Chess Boxing by Wu-Tang. So I would have these videos or VHS tapes of compilation of stuff. And like and I would watch them over and over. But that was like what Steve was saying, instead of buying them, I had a VHS where I could just like put it on. And like it was my way of like saving money.
Yeah. So through the 70s and into the 80s, this is where I think we all have firsthand experience of what was popular, what was being pushed, what was happening, because there were new music genres happening, but they were still pushing what they were making money off of. And so payola never went away, but ultimately a lot of these record labels would use third parties to do the payola. It's like, oh, you know, you'd get
independent promoters. They called them.
Yeah. Independent promoters. Yeah.
Labels could just give the money to these independent promoters. And then the independent promoters distributed it however they would amongst the people they were bribing. And the record labels could plausibly claim, we had no idea what this guy was doing.
Are we in the 80s now? Because I'm reading a great, you guys know, are you familiar with those short books? Fuck, I can't remember.
33 and a third?
Yeah, yeah, 33 and a third. I'm reading the Depeche Mode 101, the live album. And what was so fascinating was that there was one DJ, K-Rock, the guy from K-Rock, and he heard Just Can't Get Enough. So he played that on the radio. And Depeche Mode got popular in the 80s in America because he was a fan and he would play their singles on the radio.
That's how easy it was to get big, was just to get played.
Yeah.
So
that's
to realize, see, when I moved, I know that I'm jumping ahead, but when I moved to LA in 2001, I was like, oh, I can't wait to hear the radio. You know, there's gotta be radio stations that are great. And I'm sure you guys, I'm going to assume you guys like me had a radio show in college. Did you guys?
I didn't have it in college, but I had one. I had a short-lived one in my hometown for a few months, like late night.
Awesome. I didn't listen to college radio. I should have, but I had CMJ, which was a magazine.
Yeah, I used to get CMJ.
Come with a CD. Yeah,
magazine would come with a CD of just samples of all different genres. It was a great way to find.
It was a
music.
Great way to buy albums because you're like, oh, I love that song, and then you would know, like, oh, that's like that's how I got into Yo La Tengo.
What was the other one that wasn't CMJ that was more electronic?
Is it Melody Maker or
maybe it started with a? Anyways, I don't know. But yeah, Beat Melody.
I just remember. I think I was in high school, maybe 97, and I bought my first CMJ, and that my world changed. Because then I was like up on cool music, you know,
it was cool to know that people were making music outside of the genres that you listen to. And so to have a curated, like, here's something good that's new instead of just going like, go to the country section and just pick something out. Cause when we were kids and when we were coming of age, you could go into any music store, take any CD and go listen to it. And so me and my buddy would just listen. We'd spend hours there listening to music, trying to find hits.
Did you ever go to like, cause I'd go to Borders and do that. Did you ever go? And actually this applies to a story I want to tell about me and Hollywood Steve. I would go in and I'd listen to the album and you wouldn't buy it. Right.
Yeah. Cause
you just listen to it. But then the album was so good, you'd end up listening to it every time. And then you'd have to go buy it at a certain point. Did that ever happen to you?
I mean, if I liked it, I would buy it. Because I would go to a place that had used, so I'd keep a list and I'd try to find it used.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll get really quick past the story. That's how I got into Neko Case, Steve. Because you remember that, right? Me and you at Amoeba?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I would go to Borders and like I'd listen to, I think it was Blacklisted, and I'd listen to one or two songs and I'd be like, man, it's so good. I'm listening to that again. And then after a while, I'm like, I just buy this. I mean, I fucking love it. And she was in New Pornographers, which I got into them later. But then me and Steve went to see her at Amoeba, and I'll never forget this. There was like a fan of you, and he and his, I think it was his girlfriend, came up and they're like, are you Hollywood Steve? And you were like, yeah. And they're like, oh my God, we love Yacht Rock and we're big fans or whatever. And then you go, that's Steve Perry right there. And then they went, anyway, Steve. Like they looked that's at me awesome. For a second. And then like, no,
we don't want,
I
just, we don't like the show. The record, the show.
I tried.
No, but I, you know,
my
you,
gosh, you
did the awesomest thing is you tried to push it towards me, which is so nice of you. Like nobody with an ego would do that. And it's just funny. They did not care. They were like so into you.
And you know what? The thing is, I really feel like a lot, like, I don't know what fraction, but there's some percentage of the Yacht Rock fan base that thinks I did the show because they didn't see it on the Channel 101 website and they didn't read all the credits for it.
Oh, and they may not have even known what the show was. And it's like, oh, you're like, you're,
well, he's
you
the,
are the host, and you made
it's like made the same reason people think Alex Trebek used to know all the answers on Jeopardy. Like they don't think about the guys behind the scenes who write all the questions. You know,
that is so true, man. And that's the thing is like Hollywood Steve is there providing you with. It's like he's the when you open a book and you read the introduction to the book. It's like that's Hollywood Steve, he's
right?
Like,
yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
Welcome to the world of Yacht Rock. It's like you think this guy created everything. You know, and it's his show.
That's funny. Yeah, I'm
like if you watch funny. It on the one, if you watched it on the old 101 website, it would all like, oh, written by J.D. Riznar, directed by J.D. Riznar, Michael McDonald played by J.D. Riznar. But a lot of people saw it on YouTube or you know other places, and we didn't put credits you know on screen. So I think it just flew over a lot of people's heads that I was just the host. I wasn't making the show.
That's so great, man. That's so great. That person was like, they were starstruck when they saw you. Remember? They just flipped
out. Yeah. Yep.
But I got to witness like, oh my God, dude, this is a thing. Like people love mm-hmm. Yacht. It was like, mm-hmm. I mean, I felt really good for you. Cause I'm like, well, Steve is like getting the benefit of all of his, like his work and being who he is, you know, this is like his moment.
Yeah, so right. It's like you weren't cast as an actor. You were, I mean, you were friends, but you were cast because you were that guy who was the music expert.
Right. Yeah. Like I got to introduce it because I was a writer for the All Music Guide at the time.
Oh, is that how you got
it? It had been very recently when we did that.
Wow. That's crazy. Amazing. Yeah. Because like, you know, that's the thing, like the best personalities on TV or movies or just people in general that become kind of like an icon or something. It's like a person that doesn't want attention. It's a person that doesn't, they're not trying to get it. It's other people.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Putting it on them are saying, you're the guy. And they're like, no, I'm not. I'm just blah, blah, blah. And,
JD just gave me a cool nickname.
What was the nickname?
Hollywood Steve.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm saying like that, that is usually how the Hollywood Steves are created. You know, like you are who you are because other people said, dude, you're that guy. You need to be that guy. And you never had any idea or foresight to just go for that. Right. Like that's.
It's yeah, like no, accidental. none of that. I was really not trying to do any of that stuff.
Yeah.
So wait, did you guys watch The Monkees ever?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I watched The Monkees.
I love
that, yeah, right?
That's like that was my introduction to sketch comedy actually.
I definitely was a bigger fan of The Monkees than The Beatles back then and they,
absolutely.
You know, they were, for
absolutely.
Anybody who doesn't know, The Monkees were an old TV show where, you know, they weren't a real band. They were I think that they were real musicians or they ended up.
They were a real band. Mickey... They just happened to be funny and do that show.
No, they were cast for the show and like the you know, they were specifically cast to be in the band and on the show.
Because I don't think the drummer knew how to play drums, really. Anyways, go on. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, like you know, they had mostly session musicians on their records early on. And, you know, all the rock critics at the time hated that. And then they didn't realize how many other bands also had session musicians doing their records for them.
Yeah. I only bring them up because one of the band members, Michael Naismith, is that how you say it? So after this show, which was like sketch comedy with music, he was like, you know what? He basically came up with a show that played on Nickelodeon where
Nickelodeon.
I mean, he basically made one of the first real music videos ever. And so he made a show called Pop Clips, and it was basically the precursor to MTV, where they would play music videos. He was a VJ, video jockey, and he sold that idea. And then the person he sold it to came back to him later and was like, hey, do you want to keep doing this? And he's like, nah, and that ended up being MTV. And, you know, he doesn't feel bad about it. That was his idea always, was to come up with an idea and sell it. It makes sense that someone from the Monkees created MTV, because that's, and he, and you know, he doesn't claim any creation to it. He's like, somebody else would have figured it out. It's like saying you created Justice. It's like, no, this exists, you know. And I love his attitude about that. Anyways, I only bring that up because as the industry changes, which we've seen, you know, they went from record to cassette to CDs, and now with MTV getting pushed out there, MTV became the new place to really take payola, you know, and there never really been any proof of it, but whatever song was played on MTV, they had a music video for it. It became a hit. I watched MTV. I would come home from school and watch the MTV countdown every week. What's number one? What's number one?
Yeah, me too.
And I'm like, not realizing that this could all be controlled and paid off. And like, yeah, of course it was.
Did you have, was it called Box, the Box?
Not in rural Michigan, no.
Because I had a satellite.
Not in Colorado either.
My dad was weird, and he would compete with my uncle. So they would try to get the best technology to outdo the other. So my dad got a satellite so he could watch like Middle Eastern talk shows or news shows, whatever. And it had a thing from Canada called The Box. And so that was a show where whatever the hit was, they would just play the most requested videos. So I saw Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg over and over and over and over. So it would play videos that like fans would request. But it was cool because then I'd see like, oh my God, I love this song. And you'd see it like
repetitive. See, it's weird because like I love the idea of TRL, but I never watch it because I'm like, well, they're only requesting songs that MTV played on the previous show, you know. It's just like,
right,
they're not requesting like independent artists making music videos or anything.
Yeah.
It was the same way for TRL's predecessor Dial MTV, which was what was on when I was younger.
Oh, I remember
it was
that.
All like, it was mostly like hair metal videos with a few like teen pop, like Debbie Gibson or New Kids on the Block mixed in.
Ooh. So I bring up MTV because MTV, this is, in my mind, the proof that they were connected to the music industry, because they didn't play any music videos from black artists. And
at first.
And they weren't going to play Thriller. They weren't going to play Beat It. Was it Beat? Which I forget
Billy,
which
I think
one.
Billie Jean was the first one that they released to MTV.
Okay. Yeah. Billie Jean. Billie Jean. Like,
wasn't Billie Jean, because they played it, I think, because of that music awards show, right? Where he did
it. Was the Motown 25th anniversary TV.
Yeah, where he did
the moonwalk on stage.
And like,
I saw that. Yeah.
No one had seen like that kind of shit before. So that's where MTV had to play it, right?
Yeah, he kind of just forced their hand.
Yeah, he forced their hand to play it. Because like, it was like, I forget who, was it Columbia? I forget who owned Michael Jackson's music at the time, but they're like, if you don't play this, like, you're not going to get any of our stuff.
Yeah. Have you guys heard about the crazy shit with the Michael Jackson biopic? They've been trying to make it for a while, but they hit a snag because they can't talk about the child molestation stuff. So they're trying to get around it.
Who could have foreseen that?
The studio's trying to get around it, and you can't. It's fucking,
no.
Everyone knows it. It's history.
I'm leaning towards, fuck man. I've seen all the docs. I've seen the kids' docs. I've seen all the, I'm just going like, if most of this stuff was happening, the FBI would have gotten them. Anyways, I don't want to go off on Michael Jackson because I'm like, I don't know. As soon as he died, you know, what did they do? They released all these Beatles greatest hits and all of his music. Like,
here's they just a hot cashed take. Out. They here's cashed a hot out take. As soon as- I don't think he molested anybody. I think he was weird. He hung out with kids because he didn't have a childhood and he had mental problems. But I think the FBI created, because for some reason, I read about this, the FBI wanted to take him down and they knew the public would believe that he was a child molester.
They had to file him for at least a decade and they never got him.
Yeah.
And I'm just going like, it is a whole nother subject and it's weird, but I'm going like, I lean towards him being a little more innocent than not.
Yeah, because like it didn't make sense, you know. It didn't add, and also Corey Feldman, the most molested kid, wasn't molested by. Like, I'm sorry, that's a bad example. I mean, right? He was molested by like everyone in Hollywood, and Michael Jackson. Right,
he kind of won the championship.
Yeah, he won the championship. Or Macaulay Culkin, the most like everyone wants to molest him, and like Michael Jackson did it, you know. Sorry, you have a kid. Sorry, Willie.
Those are great examples. I'm with you. But
we should get past Michael Jackson because that's
so ultimately, I bring up the MTV not playing him because the industry was slow to change and they had their hand forced. That same hand, I know that Michael Jackson's doing like a little bit of disco, but like the industry was slow to hip hop. You know what I mean? Like there's this crazy stat that like the Tone Loc album is still, I believe, one of the top five hip hop albums of all time.
Tone really? Loc. Wait, is it the one with
Funky Cole Medina?
There you go. Yeah. No,
that was definitely like a rock song with rap over it, you know, and it had.
Well, what about Run DMC and Aerosmith? Like that was.
That you know, they were trying to get in on that. I mean, look, they combined the genres to try to appeal, but you're none of these. Tone Loc
was a black artist that they. Did you know what I mean? That took off and they changed.
I'm saying that I bring up the Tone Loc thing because the only way you're going to really sell albums is if you get to the white community. And this is why, you know, MTV was at the time going like, well, it's not that we don't want to play black artists, it's that we think that our audience doesn't want to watch black artists. So they're blaming the audience, and the music industry was slow to, you know, hip hop had been around for a long time, you know.
I have a theory on that because like I'm a half white kid, so I'm practically white, and MC Hammer to me was the breakthrough where I felt like that's like the first album I bought.
It was like the breakthrough of them pushing it, you know what I mean? Rapper's right. Delight in 79 did really good, but you know,
yeah, I brought up MC Hammer because that was where it I think broke through and white people would buy that album.
From the podcast that Steve sent me, they brought up MC Hammer because MC Hammer was this thing where like they didn't release a single of that because they were then trying to play with the music too, where it's like, okay, you couldn't break the Billboard 100 because you don't have a single, but the album sales was so big because you had to buy the whole album for that one song.
And that was in the 90s where they were also trying to pivot to CD singles. Where instead of paying like $2 or $3 for a cassette single, they wanted kids to pay like $6 or $7 to get the one song plus the B-side. And they just put it on a CD that had the exact same capacity as the CDs they were using to make the albums. So you'd have to pay like half price. You'd have to pay like the price you'd pay for a CD single was like one half of the album price already.
And it had the capability of holding the whole thing. I know you just said but it's just like, dude, you guys are just really trying to make, you're not saving money. You're just trying to rip everyone off.
And then they were shocked when kids started downloading stuff for free off Napster and LimeWire.
Yeah, for real. And I want to point this out for all the kids out there who don't, CD stands for compact disc because the original disc.
Oh,
here's a laser disc.
That's a record album size disc right there.
This is not a compact disc. This is a full size disc that has a whole movie on it.
Oh, I love that movie. That movie's fucking great.
I still have my laser disc player works. What?
Is there a commentary track on there with John Carpenter? If a movie, I still buy physical media, but what I look for is if a movie has commentary, I buy it.
This one does, and it's funny because it's funny. I would love to do a react video to watching commentary, but it's like you're talking over the talking. Like, you can't do it.
Well, the Total Recall would be the one, right?
Well, anything with Arnold in it, he's always like drinking, smoking cigars, and just like saying things off the top of his head.
Steve,
like,
if you haven't heard the commentary for Total Recall, it is fucking amazing. James Atkinson told it to, or showed me, because it's him and Paul Verhoeven, and they're just both crazy. Like, they're both crazy, and they're like watching the movie, and the stuff they're saying is like so ridiculous.
And Conan the Barbarian too. Same
oh,
situation.
Oh yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
De Laurentiis, Dio. What's his name? Fucking
Dino De Laurentiis.
Dino De Laurentiis, and
Dino De Laurentiis.
Also, the Showgirls commentary is really good.
De Laurentiis. Do you know who Bon Jovi's uncle is?
No.
I say probably. So. I'm sorry. His uncle, I don't know his first name. It's an Italian name. His name is Bongiovi. It's one word.
Oh, yeah.
And he produced a bunch of disco albums. He produced the disco Star Wars.
Tony Bongiovi.
Tony Bongiovi. And so it was very funny to hear that Bongiovi is Bongiovi, just the American version. It's like, oh, Bongiovi.
Well, Bongiovi's dipping. You know, you get to the point quicker.
And our first album is Bon Jovi. It's like, we're not Bon Jovi. I want to make it clear that we're Bon Jovi.
I think, what was I going to say? I think the first cassette album I bought was Ninja Turtles, like the soundtrack for the movie. And because my parents didn't let me buy music. So it was like
so
the
your first
time.
Okay, this is a great conversation. What was the first few cassettes you remember buying? You got the Ninja Turtles. What are some more? And then Steve, you go, and then I'll go.
The first cassette I ever bought with my own money was Beelzebubba by the Dead Milkmen.
Wow.
Because I saw Punk Rock Girl on MTV and was like, oh, funny songs. And then I'd read, I lived in Michigan at the time, and there was a utility infielder for the Detroit Tigers named Jim Whalewander who really loved the Dead Milkmen. And so the Detroit Free Press would write about, hey, this wacky character on the Tigers loves this wacky band. And so I had, you know, it was all this synergy happening.
Did you listen to Dr. Demento?
I never knew where to listen to Dr. Demento, so I never did.
I did on Sunday nights. My cousin, who was not my cousin, showed it to me. And yeah, dude, Dead Milkmen and Weird Al. I was like, holy shit. Like that's... I don't know. It was a cool thing where this, you know, anything, any place to find music that wasn't mainstream was always fun. Even when I was into mainstream music, it was just like, I didn't know that other people did shit. It was great to find anything.
I didn't get into really indie crazy music until like, I worked at a restaurant and I think I was 19 and this girl showed me Modest Mouse and Sunny Day Real Estate. Before that, I was just an idiot that listened to, you know, Nirvana and Weezer and Bush. So, like, she opened my brain up, and then, like, I was like,
see, we're not the same age. You're saying things that, well, I guess, I'm like, those are like when I was in college. Anyways, MC Hammer was the hip hop breakthrough, even though Beastie Boys album did okay.
The Beastie Boys' first album was the first number one rap album.
Yeah,
on the Billboard charts.
And so I only wanted to bring that up. It was the same thing of this MTV thing where it's just like, well, it was easier for them to push white rap, you know. So when the Vanilla Ice album came out, you know, it was kind of looking back, it was kind of a slap in the face to anybody who had been doing hip hop for the last decade. Yeah. You know, it's just like. Even though I love that song, I bought the single and the CD. I got the cassette single and the CD because I didn't have a CD player in my car.
I had the album on cassette because I definitely bought that.
Yeah, I had the album on cassette too.
What was this? So my first few cassettes, I don't know, man. Like, I just had too many cassettes, you know. Did you join the
Columbia Records, the Columbia Record and Tape Club ever?
I joined it at least 30 times.
Yeah.
You kept quitting because you're like, they're ripping me off. And then you're
so
like,
when we were kids, there was this, you could join this thing and you'd get 12 CDs or 12 cassettes. It was always CDs, 12 CDs.
Eight CDs for a penny or 12 cassettes for a penny.
Okay. I always did both.
And these are more expensive because they're higher quality, you understand. That's why they have to charge so much more.
When you signed up, you had to pay for one album every month.
You had to buy like X amount more. And then they would send you a card in the mail with the album of the month selection. And if you didn't return the card, they would automatically send you the album and bill you for it.
And you couldn't return it.
You'd be very on the ball if you didn't want these things or if you wanted different things.
It's like U2 putting their album on everyone's iPhone. You know, it's like,
this, yeah.
That was weird. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I got duped. I fucking didn't, I didn't cancel enough a few times and ended up with like weird albums.
What was the weirdest one that you remember that you were like, what the fuck? I don't like
Well, this. I don't know about music. I remember because I also joined, they had the same version for sci-fi and fantasy books.
Oh.
And, so I signed up to a couple for a couple of those clubs. And then I ended up getting some weird sci-fi fantasy book that was basically like fantasy porn. It was like women like with demons. And I was just like, I can't send this book back. I have to pay full price for it, which was more than CDs.
With like the Frank Frazetta art, you know.
I was just like, dude, I don't want to see these muscular demons with these like bosomed women. I'm like, but well, I also like paid full price for it.
I'm the opposite. As a kid, I would have loved that because I loved fantasy and like I couldn't see porn. So I would have been, I would buy like, for porn for like
for $24. I'd rather buy porn than whatever this fantasy book was.
Yeah, more bang for your buck there.
Like, geez, I. So the music industry was slow to change because, like, picture grunge when grunge
was
came
a big thing went to the music industry because they had played. They put all these investments into a bunch of hair metal bands because that's what the boys liked.
Hair metal was 20 years. Well, probably 15 years of
15, like 13. Like
we're all in on this.
Cause hair metal was about, hair metal's heyday was about 1983 to 1992.
Yeah.
It kind of kicked into gear with Quiet Riot and Def Leppard. And then, you know, a few years later you had Bon Jovi with the big Aquanet hairspray hairdos and, plenty of bands followed in their footsteps, and you know that was the big Dial MTV genre was hair metal, and then all of a sudden Nirvana came out with Nevermind, and this you know these underground bands that had been kind of bubbling under for a while started to take over, and everybody's like people heard Nirvana and their minds were blown, like wow, this is what we've actually been wanting to hear this whole time.
Yeah, it's and like dude, you kind of you've given me 20 metal like, what, bands. Go on.
Like almost what happened with disco, like within the year, all those older hair metal bands were like done. Their careers were over because taste had changed out from under everybody. And the record labels were pissed because they put all this money into promoting and citing and developing these hair metal bands. And there was no return on their investment.
Yeah.
Like everyone's taste changed overnight, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, so oh, that shit is lame. Wow.
So when you had the Telecommunications Act that Bill Clinton signed in 1996 that allowed all this corporate consolidation of radio, suddenly all these playlists got very, very narrow and individual DJs didn't have the discretion they used to pick songs they liked. And the record companies, instead of, you know, paying out the payola to individual DJs or like individual radio stations, program managers, suddenly they had to start bribing these corporate executives instead who were making the Clear Channel radio playlists.
Yeah. Clear Channel was all, I'm still just so offended by Clear Channel. To me, they're like the Rothschilds, you know, it's just like they bought everything out. And then this is why when I go into the store to go shopping, I'm still going to hear songs I hated 20 years ago.
Yep.
And Clear Channel changed its name to iHeartRadio. So I still fucking hate iHeartRadio. I'll never forget the who they are, who they were. It's just like this weird control of like, no, you're gonna listen to what I play for you. So they're just like,
and nothing's ever gonna change because if you like a new sound, that means that our investments go bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I mean, I really think that was the biggest factor in kind of killing off a lot of the creativity in mainstream rock was, I mean, you know, taste change over time, sure. But, you know, all the really depressing post-grunge rock was just kind of what we were stuck with for years on end, and it just didn't evolve after that. You had the kind of blip with the Strokes and the White Stripes where there was this kind of garage rock revival in the early 2000s, but that was kind of the last gasp of rock and roll as a creative force to me.
Yeah, I had a bad day.
A lot of indie rock bands, but they don't rock like they used to.
Oh, that's fucking true, man. Actually, I was friends with this guy, and he was like the son of the guy that recorded Roger Waters, and he recorded shit at Coachella, and I'd go hang out with him just because, like, we smoked weed and stuff. He was like right below Justin's house, and I would always go to hang out with him, and he played me. He said, he goes, the best band ever is the Strokes. And I'll show you why. And he had live footage, and they sounded like 10 times better live. Like, they sounded fucking amazing. And I couldn't believe, because back then I liked the Strokes, but I didn't love them. But he was like, dude, they're like the best live band. And like, he recorded them. So he knew. He recorded like Blur and Bjork and stuff. I saw a video of this guy, and he's interviewing celebrities in movies, but he had all the ticket stubs from movies like in the 90s because he saved them all. It was a compilation of him showing like Harrison Ford and all these people. I have ticket stubs, but from concerts. So check this out. I got My Bloody Valentine.
Oh.
And I got Faith No More.
Oh, I never saw either of those bands live.
Yeah, so the Faith No More show was like unbelievable because, you know,
at the Palladium, that's a great place.
Oh, dude, it was insane. It was so good. They were like 60 years old, and all of them fucking rocked. Like Mike Patton is so good live. I couldn't believe that I still had those stubs, so I just wanted to show you.
Yeah, I got all mine. I cover them in tape, basically laminate them, and throw them into a box. I have all my music and movie stubs, and
mine are in an envelope in my desk drawer somewhere.
What's like the best one you have?
Probably I think the best one is, like, I went to see the Sex Pistols reunion tour in 1996 when I was overseas doing an overseas study in England for the summer.
That's pretty
good. Wow,
that tops all.
That's I like the crown jewel in my concert collection for me.
Yeah, I like the for me, probably Beastie Boys Sabotage tour, whatever. The
whoa. Really?
I forget the name of the tour, but
that's a good one.
We called up the grocery store that was selling tickets because for some reason they were selling them. We're like, can we camp out here? And they're like, yeah, sure. So like we stayed the night in the grocery store.
Oh, nice.
And there weren't that many people behind us. Yeah, it was cool.
Like nowadays, kids don't have that. You know, they don't have that kind of experience that we had. But whatever, that's a whole nother episode.
give a minute closure to, I know that I don't know if we'd learn anything new, but just what you.
I'll plug the podcast episode that we kind of used as the inspiration for this discussion. It's an episode of Chris Melanfi's Hit Parade called The Great War on the Single, which is all about how record companies tried to get kids to spend money they didn't have and kind of fuck their own business. But yeah, I think you see the echoes of this everywhere now where you see businesses who think they have a monopoly control over whatever part of the industry that they, you know, whether it's, you know, software or TV or streaming or whatever, like all these corporations think they've got a monopoly and they can control people's tastes. And then they make the prices too expensive. And then when free, cheap alternatives come along with new technology, people immediately, you know, the younger kids like, oh, I can afford that. And they jump over to there. And all these corporations are left scratching their heads like, wait a minute, where's our business? Where's our monopoly? Why can't we control everything anymore?
Yeah.
And now I think what you see is, you know, we've moved away from physical ownership of media because companies really just want to keep their music and film and software libraries. They don't want you to have physical copies of those anymore because you can pirate those on the internet. We've moved towards we own the building, we just charge you rent to access it kind of model for all of that stuff now.
That is
And they say and like you're saying pirate, and I'm going like, well, there are a few things that I have in mind, right? Like I believe that we should own the digital version of ourselves. We should own ourselves, and they're being sold everywhere. When you buy physical media, you should also own the digital media. So I love when people do that. So like, yeah, I'll pay extra for a record if I get the digital version. I still have all my CDs and I still have all my DVDs because I'm like, you can find it online, but those rights change over years and all of a sudden you got to pay for it again and again and again. I'm like, I've already paid for it.
And I don't trust these big conglomerates to curate their libraries. Like, you know, HBO Max is pulling all their fucking classic cartoons out of circulation on streaming. Like, I'm glad they have all the Looney Tunes DVD sets.
They're constantly trying to create a want. And so, like, they'll pull it off just so that for a couple of years, just so that you want it again. It's like the Friends, you know, Friends was missing for a long time and people cared that it was gone. But I always say this.
I like too. Friends. So sorry.
If you, I mean, I, fuck man, I can't handle it.
me either.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but
if you, no, it's okay. You're going to give your closing in a second. I'm just saying that. So in the realm of algorithms, I always try to promote, don't let the algorithm choose the next video you're going to watch. Like, stop it and play your own. If you let the algorithm, like on YouTube, you're watching something, it's going, hey, here's the next suggestion. They're just making their own money off the things that they're pushing. They're only going to push things that they're paying for. So make sure you don't let the video, the next video play of any streaming site.
Eventually, you're just going to end up at Andrew Tate. That's where the, that's all algorithms lead to Andrew Tate.
Thank you. I mean, yeah. What do you got, Abed?
I still buy physical media, actually.
Oh, yeah, me too.
I love Criterion. Too. I love Arrow Video and Shout Select. They put out great movies, and I buy records. Like, I'll buy – if I really want an album or love an album, and they put out, like, the vinyl, I'll get it. Because then I own it. It's something I can treasure and have forever. It doesn't matter. Like, I have the Freaks soundtrack, you know, with Henry Rollins, and that's – that's something that I prize. Got it signed by Henry Rollins.
I'll buy it from you.
No, I'm not selling that. That soundtrack is only available through, it was like, anyway, it's rare.
Listen, everybody out there, thank you for listening. It's funny because there's no conspiracy. We just talked about the different ways that the music industry is corrupt, and it still is, and it just will never stop being that.
I mean, it is a conspiracy. It's just like right there out in the open. There's nothing secret about it.
If you're a musician, please keep making stuff. And you sure, if you got to be a studio musician and record some shit for other people, great, but keep making your own shit.
Can I plug a band? I just saw Early Mart perform, and it's a band from like Fresno that he just resurfaced again. And like he said, he started making music again because he loves it so much. He doesn't care if it.
Great. Yeah. What is it?
Early Mart.
Early Mart.
Early Mart. It's one word with an I instead of a Y.
And and what else? What else you plug in? Abed Hour. What else you got, Abed?
I'm doing a webtoon with Mike Chilean called Lieutenant DePopo Dog Detective. It's like a lot to remember. So if you go to my Instagram, you can subscribe there on Webtoon or Tapas.
Awesome. And Steve, give out all your plugs right now. What do you? What
all
you
right, got going on? I'm going to plug Yacht Rock, a doc, D-O-C-K, U-mentary on HBO Max, still streaming. Me and old J.D. Riznar, the creator, two of the people who keep the fire burning for the Yacht Rock web series and genre are heavily featured in that. Me and the other Yacht Rock fellows also have a couple podcasts. We have the Yacht or Nyacht podcast, where we take listener suggestions who've joined our Patreon at $2 a month. We take their suggestions on what songs we should rate on the Yachtsky scale of 1 to 100 for how smooth and yachty they are. And then we also have Beyond Yacht Rock, which is an old podcast we did from like 2016 to 2019. And we've recently rebooted as Beyond Yacht Rock 2000, because it's the future now, you understand. And in that show, every episode we make up a new genre of music because, hey, we hit with Yacht Rock. One of these has to fucking hit another time, right? right. And we count down the top 10 songs in that genre.
That's great.
Those are available awesome. On Spotify and Apple Podcasts and wherever the hell else podcasts are cast.
I was in an episode of Smiling Friends, so watch that on Adult Swim.
Snap.
7, I think. Anyway, they're great. Those guys are all super talented.
Great. And for myself, you know, thank you for supporting us, Real Life Sci-Fi. Like, please follow us everywhere. That if you haven't followed our YouTube or whatever, even just following our Patreon, even if you don't pay anything, like, that helps us. Really Bad Movies, follow that. I'm supposedly gonna keep making more of those, but try to make some real movies with that eventually one day. But thank you to our guests, Steve and Abed. I love always over the years talking to you guys at parties about fucking music and movies and all the things. And
remember parties?
Yeah, remember, right? When we were the coolest people there.
Terrifying.
Thank you for listening and watching. Shroud Home Video, 4 p.m. every Sunday is where you can watch this. If you're listening, thank you for that. And just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you.
That's right.
Good night.
Don't be paranoid.
Real Life Sci-Fi.